This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Reason, at SoundCloud, or at Spotify. And rate and review us when you listen. We'd like to hear what you think about what we're doing. Without a doubt, one of the biggest policy wins for Reason since our debut in 1968 has been the legalization of marijuana in the United States. Currently, about 10 states allow use for recreational purposes, and twice that number allow pot use as medicine. Donald Trump has even indicated that he'd sign legislation turning control of pot back over to the states. So when Reason celebrated its 50th anniversary in November in Los Angeles, we put together a panel devoted to talking about how drug policy has changed over the years, the difficulties in actually implementing pot legalization, and a discussion of how drugs that the government once considered illicit, things like LSD, MDMA, psilocybin, and more, are now being talked about not simply as ways to get high, but ways to become more mentally healthy and happy. The panelists for this include Dr. Adrian Moore. He's a PhD who runs the research division of Reason Foundation, and he consults with cities and states actually implementing marijuana legislation. Dana Rohrabacher, the longtime Republican member of Congress from Orange County, who consistently pushed to end the federal war on pot. And Jacob Sollum, a Reason senior editor who has written about drug policy for years and is the author of the excellent book, Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. We're going to pick up this discussion, which I moderated, as Adrian Moore starts his remarks.
We had a realization a while back that the process of a pretty widespread alliance of groups, individuals, organizations that have been working for legalizing marijuana in either medical or recreational in various states, with, as everybody knows, kind of a snowballing success lately. But this is a gross oversimplification, but it's also really true that that has largely been a progressive movement. And so the folks who have been very effective at getting marijuana legalized aren't overwhelmingly free market oriented. So as a result, we have some really interesting political dynamics going on when state X legalizes either medical or recreational marijuana, that then you're taking a market out of the black market and into the white market, so to speak. And there's got to be some rules because all markets have rules. And the natural tendency of pretty much everyone involved is to really regulate the living hell out of this market. And there's lots of forces at work there. First of all, there's basically all the players are not particularly market-oriented folks. You've got legislators and you've got a lot of pro-legalization groups who are not oriented around free markets. It's just not their bent. And so we thought, well, there's a missing piece there, which is the how do you actually create, you know, sort of minimally regulated free markets, and how do you make the case for that when you've got not just sort of, well, we're creating this new market, so we have to regulate it because that's just the natural assumption of the political establishment that's writing the laws and writing the regulations, but there's, you know, sort of on the right, you've got a either outright resistance to this legalization, or they're sort of holding their nose and saying, well, okay, it seems to be medically beneficial, or the war on drugs. I meet a lot of Republican legislators, for example, say, well, the war on drugs is a disaster, so we've got to legalize. But this stuff is terrible, and so I want to legalize it in a way where hopefully no one will ever use it. Which leads to weird regulations, right? So, and then there's just like a yucky factor, like this thing is scary and weird and not, you know, has to be controlled. And so I literally just this morning was reading a new report that came out in New Hampshire that lays out the framework for their coming legalization, presumably. It seems to be what everybody believes is going to happen there. And it's, you know, it's we legalized liquor and we really don't worry about like how many bottles of liquor people have in their house. But with pot, 1 ounce, that's it. If you got more than that, something terrible is going to happen. So we have to have state rules on how much you can have in your house, on your person, et cetera. You know, if a store selling cannabis also sells potato chips, people will die. I know we made a video about that. So you absolutely cannot sell snacks or tobacco or anything that you might find in, say, a pharmacy or a liquor store being sold besides the drugs or the liquor. You cannot do in cannabis stores pretty much anywhere in the United States. It just keeps going on. My favorite things are, we want a state agency to determine the total amount of marijuana that's going to be consumed in the state. I should say cannabis, because edibles, the whole nine yards, oils, and then establish the production of those products to meet that predicted demand. I mean, the rules they're trying to write to manage supply and demand go beyond the craziest things the Soviet Union did with grain back in its heyday. But that'll work, right? We can do that. We're so smart in New Jersey. We can accurately make these economic predictions. So suffice it to say that without exception, all of these markets are just loaded with crazy, economically ignorant rules that perpetuate black markets. We have black markets everywhere we have legal markets, which kind of defeats the purpose in a lot of ways. And there's also, though, some recognition that this is the case. It's still early days, but I look at Colorado. Colorado's progression of revising its regulations. First of all, they took an approach that said, we will be going through multiple revisions. So they have not hesitated to both do new legislation each year, but also the regulators have been revising the rules at least once a year since they legalized. And that has, on net, been a steady liberalization of the market. And hasn't been a one-way ratchet. There's been, some nonsense, but largely they've been liberalizing that market because they're finding that over-restrictive markets have problems. And I think that lesson hopefully will start to spill over. So,
Adrian, just to wrap up, would you say that if Colorado is the model so far for a statewide implementation regime, what state is either doing the worst or seems to about do the worst?
Well, the worst is California. Shocking, I know. They put out a set of new rules in the summer that were pretty grim. We commented and had a lot of meetings with regulators trying to persuade them to change some things. They just came out with revisions to those rules, comments of which are due this week. They actually did move a few items in the right direction, so progress. But it's clearly going to be, we're taking a multi-year strategy in that state. New Jersey is currently wrestling with legislation. The bill hasn't been introduced, but literally everybody in New Jersey has been looking at the draft bill for a while now. It's bad in many ways, but it's also really good in many ways. Like it's a great combination of keeping a lot of dumb ideas, but actually learning a lot from some of the states like Colorado that have already legalized. So we'll see where the political horse trading ends.
Well, we'll end your comments, the prepared comments there, and you can come back and talk to Adrian about your specific state, maybe. In the question and answer period, we're going to leave a lot. Congressman Rohrabacher has arrived. This is him right here. And now we're going to ask him to talk for about 5 minutes about the long, strange trip. I think you can just... Is it too high, or are you too high, Congressman, or is the microphone high?
The microphone is good.
But the long, strange trip since reason began in 1968 to legalization, pending legalization of marijuana at the federal level, which or at least descheduling that you've been pushing. What is it like to be at the forefront of just about the biggest boulder in legal history for the past 50 years?
Okay, so what's it like? Let me just say this, that the boss I used to work for said, Well, Dana, make sure you start off with a little funny story. And that answers, this story may answer your question. And that is about, because I'm seeing faces that I haven't seen now for about 20 years. And a story about this fellow who grew up with his gang of friends, and they sort of split apart as they got older. And but he never forgot his old gang, and he was tremendously successful. And he invites them over to his house to show off this big mansion he lives in. And they go to the backyard. He says, I want you fellows to see something. And he pushes a button, and the cover comes off the swimming pool, and it's filled with alligators and crocodiles, sharks, piranhas, everything you can imagine. And he said, look, I have been so enormously successful since we all hung around together. Let me share a little bit of this with you. Anybody who can swim across this pool, I'm going to give $500,000. And they all look at each other and look at the sharks there. And so, and he says, well, I didn't think anybody would be stupid enough to pick me up on it. Come on, we got a barbecue over here. As they're walking towards the barbecue, hears a splash. He turns around, and one of his old buddies is trying to beat his way across the pool, hitting the sharks on the nose, fighting away the alligators. Finally, he gets up to the end, and his friend runs over to him and says, that was tremendous. How do you want me to give you that 500 thou? And his friend said, I don't care about the money. I just want to know who pushed me in that pool. And and when you come to talking about issues like this, I'm wondering who pushed me in that pool. And it might have been Bob Poole for the old timers here. So, this issue has always been a freedom issue with me. And it hasn't been a personal, you know, for a couple of years, I smoked marijuana when I was a kid, and I stopped when I was 23 because I thought it was having a bad impact on my life, and I haven't touched it since. I put some cannabis salve on my arm when I had some pains in my arm from doing too much surfing. And I remember I was on the Bill Maher show, and some guy was commenting about how you can't trust Clinton because he talked about, he tried to tell us, well, I didn't inhale, you know, and I said, we should have known about him then. The guy said, what about you? Did you inhale? I said, listen, buddy, when I was younger, I did everything but drink the bong water. So, but the fact is, what kind of life would I have lived and what type of things that I would have contributed to our society had I been arrested and put in jail? I would never have been able to be working the White House with Reagan. Wouldn't have been hired in the campaign had I been arrested like that, much less. And I'm very proud of the things I was able to accomplish during the Reagan years. Actually, Marty Anderson and Milton Friedman agreed with us on this particular issue. We didn't dominate that, obviously, but we had a major impact on the intellectual discussion at high levels on this at that point. That's about as much as we could succeed in. And during my years in Congress, I'm proud of that. But had I been arrested, I wouldn't have accomplished anything for my country. I wouldn't have pushed anything for the cause of freedom or anything. So there is a huge price that we're paying for this. And the price actually is even greater for some young people who come from poor neighborhoods. I mean, they get arrested for a baggie of marijuana, and they spend days in jail, and then they get a public defender saying, you got to plead guilty, and then they'll give you, they won't, you have to spend too much more time in jail, which they do, and for the rest of their life, they have a criminal record. And unlike people in more affluent neighborhoods, where as soon as they get arrested, there's their family lawyer there getting them out of jail immediately and making a deal with the judge. So in the end, their whole record is expunged. I mean, this type of injustice has been going on, as well as, of course, we understand there are people who, because marijuana has been illegal, we are now finding out there are incredible treatments that people can take for their pain and suffering that have not been permitted to even, we haven't even permitted to have research into it for 100 years. So we've reached a new plateau now, and I'm very proud that I played a part in that.
Would you talk about, because we're going to come back in the question period as well to these okay. things, but could you summarize quickly what are the actions you're taking now to change right. or to try and introduce legislation okay. that would change the federal relationship to marijuana? Right.
Well, remember, the success that I've had has not been based on the premise of trying to convince people to believe in freedom. The freedom issue, I would call it, to me it always was a freedom issue, or for other people on the left, a suffering issue. You know, people are suffering and we can alleviate that. But what worked, I mean, for years I was talking about legalizing cannabis and not successful in the Congress because I was stressing freedom and trying to talk about suffering of other people and such. But what permitted me to win what we have won so far is to couple it with the states' rights issue, because conservatives were the key votes in achieving a majority on any step forward. And I realized that to get their vote, they had to have something that they would make them contradictory to everything they've been saying, which is they've always believed in the 10th Amendment. Republicans, the 10th Amendment this, the 10th Amendment that, states' rights, and blah, blah. And so I, of course, said this, medical marijuana should be left up to the states. And when I was able to present that amendment to the, basically, it was to the appropriations bill for the Department of Justice, that's how I succeeded. And we won that. And I succeeded with about 30 or 40 Republicans at the first vote. We had more later, and almost all the Democrats. And that was, I think, 5-6 years ago. And we now have come to that point that we have an $8 billion industry now, just based on medical marijuana cannot be touched by the DEA if the states have legalized its medical use. The next step in this is, of course, to have a bill that says that the Justice Department, or maybe, well, I have a bill that I think is the next step, that says no department of our government, of our federal government, shall use its power to try in an inconsistent way with states, with the way the states have designated cannabis in their state. So that would mean the Department of Justice, yes, about all marijuana, not just medical marijuana, but also the banks, et cetera, and Department of Treasury.
That's also a rider you're talking about?
No, that's a bill that I have proposed. Yes, it would be correct. Standalone bill. I will continue to move forward to try to keep this amendment on the Department of Justice bill, but I have my own standalone bill. The only reason we succeeded, by the way, was I was permitted to have a vote to have that amendment on the Department of Justice appropriations bill. If I would not have been permitted to have that vote, we would not have won. Now, so someone in the Republican leadership wanted me to have that vote because I was pushing for it.
But you're not sure who it was.
Yeah, I know who it was.
Just whisper it.
We'll just figure out who was Speaker at the time. That's all you have to do.
Who might also be a lobbyist for marijuana right now in his retirement. Congressman, just as a final question before we go on to Jacob, Donald Trump, both as a candidate and I guess as president, has said that he would sign a bill allowing the states to regulate marijuana as they see fit. Do you believe, is he telling the truth there? Or let me put it this way, not is he telling the truth as he sees it, or would he actually sign a bill if it came across his desk?
He is absolutely telling the truth.
Yeah.
You can count on it.
All right. All right. That's great. So, all right. Thank you. Now we're going to hear from Jacob Sullum. And Jacob, who has been with Reason for a quarter of a century and has written widely and wisely about drug policy. Jacob, I'd be interested in hearing what do you think happened that pot in particular became legal, but then also more importantly, a lot of your work now is talking about the ways in which we can start to really reconfigure our relationship and our discussion about drugs as kind of ways of becoming engaging our world better. Discuss a little bit about your interest in that and where you see things going.
Okay.
All right, so we're supposed to talk about the future of drug policy, and I should start by saying I have a long track record at being really bad at predicting what's going to happen with drug policy. In general, I've been too pessimistic. I've been pleasantly surprised. I did not think that marijuana would be legal this soon. I thought I would see it in my lifetime, basically, but I didn't think it would happen this soon. And I was also wrong in predicting that emphasizing medical use was a mistake. I thought that this was a strategy that would backfire because people would say, well, we know why you really want to legalize pot. And especially given the pretty loose regime in California, where basically, you know, almost anybody who wants to get pot can get a note from his doctor, and there are lots of doctors who are happy to write the notes, that it was basically recreational legalization in the guise of medical legalization. I thought that would backfire on the movement and discredit it. To the contrary, what happened is that emphasizing medical use was help prepare public opinion for this broader change. And people looked at California and they said, well, if this is what actual legalization looks like, which they basically said it's de facto legalization. You know, the sky did not fall, was not a huge disaster. So why not, you know, stop the pretense of having to get a doctor's note and just make it legal officially? I think we are seeing something similar with other drugs. So if you ask what happens next, what's the next, you know, substance where the laws are going to be reformed? Psychedelics are clearly, moving ahead. And something similar is happening because, I mean, and this is another situation where I never would have predicted this would happen, that you could get, you know, MDMA was banned back in 1985, basically because people started to use it for fun, and that's intolerable. I mean, that's what happened. The DEA said, oh, people are using this at parties? No, it's got to be banned. And the people who were objecting at that time were saying, look, this is very useful in psychotherapy. We think it's very promising. And the government didn't listen to them. I'm amazed that it's a few decades later, but I'm amazed that MDMA is probably going to be approved as a prescription drug within a few years. And it was a matter of jumping through all the bureaucratic hoops, doing the research that was demanded. And this is like an incredibly promising, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder, incredibly promising treatment. You look at the studies, and these are just very dramatic improvements that people are seeing. And so it's undeniable. And the FDA has not approved it yet, but it has designated it as a breakthrough therapy. It's facilitating the process. They're in the stage three clinical trials, phase three clinical trials, and it's all but certain that it will be available by prescription within a few years. Something similar is also happening with psilocybin. Also was recently designated as a breakthrough therapy by the FDA, and it's in a similar context. It's being used not as a drug you take every day to make you feel better or to moderate your mood, but as a catalyst. So in this case, it's as a treatment for depression as opposed to PTSD, but probably both of these things would be useful in both of those contexts. And so that's very, I mean, this was a drug that was completely disreputable until recently. And soon that may also be available. The question is, how do you move from a situation where you can get it by prescription to a situation where you don't need a doctor's note? And I'm not sure how that happens. If this is done at the federal level, how that happens. But I don't want to be overly pessimistic about it, because I think with the history of marijuana has shown us that emphasizing the benefits, medical, I mean, they call them medical. I don't really think the benefits of MDMA and psilocybin are not, strictly speaking, medical, but they are benefits. That's the way you have to frame things. If you want to get drugs approved in the United States, you have to say it's to treat a disease, even if it's not really treating a disease, right? You have to pretend that you're treating a disease. So that's problematic, because I would like to not only see psilocybin and, you know, other psychedelics be available to any adult who wants to use them for whatever reason, but also the most exciting thing would be to develop new compounds that do specific things for specific amounts of time, without the side effects of some of these other things. And there really is no way to do that unless you say this is to treat a disease. So that's problematic. I think that rhetoric is problematic. But at the same time, the fact that these drugs, these prohibited drugs, are being recognized as useful and beneficial in at least certain ways means that the policy is becoming more tolerant and more permissive. And, you know, so I don't want to be overly pessimistic. I think it's possible that, you know, by the time I die, these drugs will be, you know, the psychedelics will be available to adults and that you won't need a doctor's note anymore.
Could you, Jacob, maybe hazard a guess as to, you know, I mean, this stuff has evolved over years and it kind of goes in punctuated equilibrium leaps, but what changed? I mean, you know, even in the 90s, you know, and I mean, there's no question people like Bill Clinton, people like Joe Biden, I mean, they were drug warriors, but they lost. Why did they lose?
Well, I mean, with marijuana, I think it's quite clear what happened is that this is a drug that used to be seen as exotic. It was used by other people, not us, and it became a mainstream drug. This is a rite of passage for people of a certain generation. Most people have tried it, and they certainly know, if they haven't tried it themselves, they know people who have. And it was very hard to scare people about this drug that became so familiar. Psychedelics are harder because they're not nearly as popular as marijuana. But I think that's where the emphasizing these benefits, especially you have sympathetic study subjects like the veterans, that was really a big part of getting MDMA moving it through the process, was emphasizing the benefit to veterans, because that's politically very powerful. And it's not bullshit. I mean, it's true. It really does. It does benefit them. And so that has helped. And I think to the extent that you can move away from, you know, using a drug just for fun, recreationally, right? Not to knock recreation, it's very important. I think people start to take you seriously.
Co-equal with the rise of, I mean, you know, the rise of prescription drugs starting in the 70s, really. I mean, there weren't that many drugs that doctors were prescribing, and now everybody's on something.
Yeah. So,
so why not a little bit of MDMA?
You can take Prozac every day in order to make yourself, you know, less melancholy and more functional.
Right.
Why not have a drug you just take a few times as a catalyst that improves your life as well? It fits into that.
I think all we need to do is finalize the name of that drug. I think Molly and ecstasy are probably going to be prohibited. Try and come up. Let's go to questions and answers. Questions about drug policy in the 21st century, and please wait for the microphone, Zach. Why don't you go over to Dr. Jeff Singer?
Thanks. I have a question actually for Congressman Rohrabacher. It appears that the argument of the states' rights argument has really become the argument that sells sort of across the spectrum, so that it looks like the writing's on the wall. Eventually, using that argument, marijuana is going to be legal throughout the country, and probably pretty soon. Using that same argument, we have the heroin and fentanyl crisis. It used to be called the opioid crisis, but it's really the heroin and fentanyl crisis. And in every country in the developed world since starting in the 80s, supervised injection facilities have been found to be very effective in stopping the spread of disease and also having people handy to stop overdoses with naloxone. The only country it doesn't exist in, actually there's one, it's subterranean in Minnesota, but the only country that it doesn't exist in is the United States, because as recently as I think 6 weeks ago, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein said it's against federal law to have a federally prohibited substance on the premises. And if you set up a supervised injection facility, we're going to come after you. There are numerous locations, Philadelphia, Seattle, San Francisco, that are wanting to set up supervised injection
facilities. What's your question then, Jeff?
Can we use that same argument to get the federal government to allow states that want to set up supervised injection facilities to do it?
I mean, I don't quite understand.
The question is, could the states' rights argument that you're using to push marijuana legalization also be used to allow supervised injection sites that are currently prohibited under federal law?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, Jeff, there is precedent for this, because the federal drug paraphernalia statute makes an exception for distribution of drug paraphernalia that is legal under state and local law. And that allows needle exchange programs without violating the paraphernalia statute. And you're seeing the same debate played over again that we had about needle exchange with supervised injection facilities. The same arguments, people who are against it say this endorses drug use and encourages drug use. It's bad. And really, you know, more quietly, what they're thinking is we want drug use to be as dangerous as possible. The better to deter people. I mean, some people make that argument explicitly. The governor of Maine vetoed a bill to make naloxone more widely available with precisely that argument, saying, well, I don't want people to have the assurance that if they overdose, they can reverse the overdose.
We do know in my situation, there was a company that produces jars and little containers that they had made in China and were imported specifically for cannabis and different shapes and sizes, and it was being held up at the port, and so they asked me to see if I could free their container filled with these jars and things. So I they said this is drug paraphernalia and for cannabis, however, and so I did call up and made a pitch saying, look, you should not, U.S. Customs should not stop this. This is something that's legal here in California. And with Rohrabacher Farr Amendment says that, you know, we should not be getting in the way of state law. And it is legal in this state. And they bought onto it and they allowed the container to come through. Now, I don't know what a court would decide on this. I'm not sure. That's why I had to answer. I don't know. Until the courts are deciding that way, we don't know exactly what the law of the land will be.
All right. Next question.
This question is for Adrian and Congressman Rohrabacher. I know, Adrian, you've been doing a lot of work in New Jersey, and I just wonder, what is the role of grassroots groups, in particular in a lot of states like North Dakota, Oklahoma, Mississippi on the horizon, particularly right-of-center grassroots groups, in directing the policy maybe in a more free market direction?
Huge, actually. So a key part of our strategy in the states we're working in and the states we're planning to work in the coming couple of years is a partnership with those kind of organizations, the dominant one being Americans for Prosperity, where, you know, they have a grassroots organization, they have a lot of local relationships, but they don't have any expertise on drug policy. So we team up. We have the expertise, and they have sort of the ground team, and that's actually working extremely well. So I foresee that being, you know, more and more central. And in each state we're working in, then that sort of builds out. So we wind up working with other groups. And, you know, there's existing groups like Drug Policy Alliance and MPP, and we, you know, we don't agree on everything, but we agree on legalizing and the general direction of things. And so, you know, there's a lot of ways we can cooperate with those more grassroots-based groups in these different states.
Next question. How about right there? Yep.
So it seems like we're kind of stuck at the moment with this substance-by-substance approach. Is there any hope for a broader reconsideration of drug policy or policy towards substances that people ingest?
Wow, that's a good question. So you want like a complete rewrite, like a consciousness, an act of higher consciousness, the Rohrabacher higher consciousness act?
I say no.
You would be shocked at, you know, in spite of the kind of the enlightenment with regards just to marijuana that's been going on, the number of people who are deeply, deeply brainwashed about marijuana is astonishing when you really start interacting with them in large groups. Well, so there's a lot of cultural movement that still hasn't happened, even on marijuana. So, you know, the journey is still long.
And it's not, I mean, right? People, there's actually a great piece in the anniversary issue by Jonathan Rauch, where he talks about, you know, how did the public come to support marijuana legalization? And he likens it to how did they come to support gay marriage rights? And because the trajectory of public opinion is very similar when you look at the two of them, back in the late 60s, I think the first Gallup poll that was done on the question found like 15% support. And now it's like 65% support. And that's huge.
And continuing to climb.
So I think that this is basically it's not a matter of principle. It's not like people woke up and said, oh, yeah, everybody should have a right to control their own bodies and what goes into them. They just became convinced that this particular drug was not as bad as the government said. And that was a matter of experience. Their own direct experience or indirect experience with it convinced them that what the government was saying was mostly nonsense. And so you can't extrapolate from that and say, now you could try to say, well, what the government said about marijuana was bullshit. Maybe what they say about methamphetamine is also bullshit. But it's a much harder sell because most people are not using methamphetamine, you know.
Yeah, off the top of your head, can you quote, I mean, the magnitudes of difference where it's basically half of everybody, every adult in America has tried pot, whereas, you know, the numbers of people who have actually tried methamphetamine or even cocaine are in the digits.
Yes, it's much smaller. And especially, I mean, the opioid thing is really hard, not just because these drugs, the reputation that they have, but because of the injection. That's something that most people are never going to want to do, that route of administration in particular.
Do you work for a needle company? Is this your secret agenda here?
It shouldn't be the case that we don't want to be saying marijuana should be legal because it's really not that bad. That is kind of what happened, but that's unfortunate because you have all these drugs that are much more dangerous than marijuana, but keep making them illegal does not make them less dangerous. The argument should be precisely because these drugs are dangerous, potentially deadly, they should be legal because that's the way you reduce the potential for harm. Clearly makes the drugs more dangerous in many respects to have them be illegal. Yeah. So that's sort of the next step is based on a harm reduction kind of argument. But again, it's not a matter of principle because that people don't accept that principle.
We know that just because certain people have attitudes doesn't necessarily mean a certain percentage of the population believes something. That does not always translate into a change in the law. There are interest groups. There are various people who are at play at making law in our country. And most people, in terms of a general perception of marijuana that has impacted on people who make law, a lot of people in our country went through the 60s and they saw these images on TV, or they went to their park and they think that if a person they smokes marijuana, some guy smoking marijuana is going to grow his hair long and they're going to go fornicate in the park. You know, that's their image of what the impact of marijuana is.
And didn't that kind of happen? I mean, when you think about it, it's...
I won't comment
well,
on that.
Well, you know...
But what I'm going to say is that if now, because we have permitted the states to legalize the medical use of marijuana, now more and more people are seeing there is a positive impact here. And especially, you say, with veterans and those people, once that public opinion and those specific people go to the specific people who are making the law, their member of Congress or their state legislature, that has an impact. It doesn't have a general idea, again, acceptance of marijuana or whatever, is not the goal. The goal is to make sure that those people making the law are influenced by those people they represent. And I have always told people to make sure you get your veterans, get your senior. I traveled with a group of senior citizens to a marijuana clinic a couple weeks ago. And, older people now are beginning. This isn't a young people's drug where people are out having fun. These are people who have trouble sleeping at night. They have aches and pains. They feel alone and they're depressed. And there's no reason in the world why someone like that shouldn't be able to use cannabis to uplift their spirit, bring their appetite back. So anyway, the seniors now are a factor that's a positive factor and not a negative factor in making the determination of a member of the legislature or the Congress of whether how they're going to vote on this issue.
So you guys really didn't turn into your parents. That's kind of nice to hear that the baby boom has something going for it. It is really interesting, and I'm sure Adrian could talk at length about this as well. When you start to look at special interests, do ideas or principles move public policy, or is it really getting at special interests? And there is such a vast set of structures in place to maintain the drug war as is. And then they'll be like, okay, you know what? We're going to give up the province that is marijuana, but we're not. We're still going to have prisons. We're still going to have substance abuse counselors, et cetera.
But we remember the people on the other side. We're talking about an inconsistency there. And look, I've always looked at this as a freedom issue because I have my libertarian background. It's freedom of people's right to injustice, and especially this is one we can succeed in. So I focus only on trying to go one step there at a time. But other people, remember, who are supporting this with me and it's not a freedom issue to them. It's whatever you can. Okay, you mentioned about all these other controls, but what about the liberals that are voting? Yes, we're going to allow the states to have medical marijuana laws and legalize it that way. But in this state, how much regulation are they imposing on those people who are in the marijuana business? They don't believe in freedom at all. They believe in getting something in, and then we can tax it and control it. And it's not a freedom argument with them. Yeah. So the freedom argument doesn't work at that point. And by the way, I think that right now, between the time that I first got this Rohrabacher Farr Amendment passed to make sure the DEA was out of the picture for medical marijuana, till now, and we've seen this creation of this $8 billion industry, this is going to be known as the golden age of cannabis, because once it's legalized in all these states where you got liberal Democrats like this, they're going to be just overwhelmed with the regulatory controls that are placed on them as business people who are selling something that is consumed by the product, by the public. They're just going to be overwhelmed by that, because that's not a freedom argument at all with the liberals. So,
you can argue, though, about the consequences. And if you want to displace the black market, which everyone says they want to do.
Correct.
Look, if you make a drug legal and it's more expensive now, you're doing something wrong. I mean, that's there was an estimate from some industry analyst who said that marijuana sold in state licensed stores in California is something like 75% more expensive than it is on the black market. That's a serious problem. And they're taxing the hell out of it. They're regulating the hell out of it. And it's a big mistake. Look, I would set the tax rate at zero and keep it at zero. But if they were smart, they would at least start out zero, and they could try to raise it later.
It would be subject to the same sales tax as a candy bar or something.
Yeah, it would have the same. It wouldn't have any special marijuana tax.
Right.
But for sure, they should start out with it either at or near zero in order to help displace the black market. And then maybe later on, if they're trying to raise some revenue.
They can't do that.
Yeah.
They can't, because they're liberal Democrats and they can't do that, who control the state.
But if they're interested in raising money, they should.
They should. Right. They should do all that. No, they he just pointed out one thing. All this money that they've caused now, because that money was going to the drug cartels, and now it's not. But if you tax it too high, the money is still going to the drug cartels.
I'll just jump in.
Next question, yes.
So we're having this important and needed national conversation right now around the opioid crisis. And my question is, as we are having this conversation, what do we need to be cognizant of, or really make sure that as we're messaging around it, we are focusing on, so that the fear and the panic created by this crisis doesn't set us back on the important advancements we've made culturally around the tolerance for marijuana and increasingly around psilocybin and psychedelics and things like that?
It's an interesting question. Jacob, start?
I mean, the main thing, what I've been emphasizing, is various kinds of harm reduction policies, and we have to focus on what people are concerned about. The thing that we're concerned about is people are dying. Well, why are they dying, and in what kind of situation, and how does the law contribute to making that, you know, drug use riskier than it would otherwise be? So that you can start to nibble at the edges of that by saying, the real analysis is you're taking people who maybe were taking, you know, legally produced opioids where they knew what they were getting, and you're pushing them into a black, by cracking down on that, you're pushing them into a black market where the risks are much higher. They don't know what you're getting. And they should stop doing that, or at least they should take into consideration that people will substitute more dangerous drugs for the relatively safe, not to say they're completely safe, but the reliable, legally produced supply. they have to, you try to get people to think about, you know, you crack down on this and then something, there's going to be a response. There always is. And in all likelihood, you're going to increase the hazards. Things like, you know, safe injection facilities, widely distributing naloxone despite, what's his name, LePage's opposition, that is actually a consensus issue. Pretty much everybody agrees with that. People agree with you know, make treatment more widely available. What is treatment? You know, buprenorphine and methadone are really the only opioids, or the only ones you're allowed to use for maintenance treatment. Why is that? What if we allowed other ones that people might find more appealing, they might be more willing to take? Isn't it better for somebody to take this reliable dose under doctor's supervision than to try to fend for themselves in the black market? So I'm hoping eventually you can start to make those arguments. The battle over needle exchange was basically won, and not only is it legal, but I don't think it should be federally subsidized, but it actually isn't. It's federally subsidized, so that's kind of amazing. It's the same basic principle. If you're worried about people dying and the damage that's being caused, you have to talk about practical things that you can do to reduce the damage that's caused by the war on drugs and try to build a consensus around them.
I think it's also important to talk about opioids, not simply in the context of a drug issue or a drug war issue or you know, harm reduction. When you look at the places where opioid problems seem to be cropping up, and I think in many ways they're overstated, kind of in a similar way that we're talking about migrant caravans as if there's an army of, you know, a million orcs slowly coming up into the Mexican border as opposed to like 7,000 people. The numbers have increased a lot, but they're still not huge in absolute terms. But who are the people who are abusing opioids? Who are the people who are becoming, you know, trapped in cycles of dependency? And there are large-scale social and economic issues that really need to be talked about there, and about labor force participation rates among men. I wouldn't call it deindustrialization of the Northeast and Midwest, because that happened decades ago. But there's a lot of people who are hanging around who don't have anything to do, and it becomes a kind of alternative lifestyle. And I think really stressing a more holistic understanding of where are these problems cropping up and why, and how do we address something larger than that? Because it's not a good life. It isn't happy, blissful, you know, finding your inner peace or anything like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that's just that's very important, because we have to get away from this idea that it's the drug that causes the addiction.
Right. Yeah, in this case, I think it is really the larger kind of socio-economic situation. Yeah.
And it feeds into the whole issue of pain treatment. People think that there's a high risk of addiction for pain patients, and it isn't. It's very small risk, and so they also are suffering as a result of this crackdown. People who really need opioids in order to have a livable life, they get caught in the crossfire in this, and that's another issue to bring out and show how these current policies are causing harm.
So we are at 10:50. We're going to take a break now. I want to thank Adrian Moore, Jacob Solem, and Congressman Rohrabacher for talking about the future of drug policy at Reason's 50th anniversary gala.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. This was a special presentation from our 50th anniversary celebration in Los Angeles in November. Hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Reason, at SoundCloud, at Spotify, wherever you find us. And thanks for listening.